WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Mason Chambliss with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, August 5th. Deciding to not follow in the footsteps of Manatee County, the city of Bradenton will continue to utilize speed cameras in school zones during the school year. Although the use of the cameras has received criticism from the public and was voted down by the county commissioners, the Bradenton police have affirmed the effectiveness of the cameras and said that they will continue to use them. Tickets will be given for violations starting August 11th, the day classes resume. Raw milk is illegal to sell in Florida for human consumption. Even so, the Florida Department of Health yesterday sent a health warning regarding human consumption of raw milk after 21 cases of raw milk-related illnesses were reported in central and northwest Florida. All the cases stemmed from the same farm, the name of which was not disclosed. Although no deaths have been reported due to the consumption of the raw milk, 1/3 of the infected have been hospitalized due to their illness. Elizabeth Bettemeyer grew up unsure as to where her next meal would come from. Her and her husband Glenn, a podiatrist, have donated $100,000 to the Mayor's Feed the Hungry program. The money will help provide food for families in Sarasota and Manatee counties. Governor Ron DeSantis promises that AI-related regulations will be coming soon to Florida. Last week in Panama City, he acknowledged the economic value and general importance of AI for the future, but he also wants to ensure that too much power isn't given over to large tech corporations. He doesn't want to fight against AI as much as he wants to ensure that its use will benefit the population. He did not give a time as to when these regulations might be announced by. Emulating President Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE, Florida's own DOGE has been eyeing cities to audit. St. Petersburg is the latest city to be called upon. In a letter dated to the first of this month, Florida's DOGE has requested information regarding city-implemented programs addressing issues such as diversity and inclusion, equality, environment, and homelessness. The letter also says that property taxes in the city have increased by 75% over the past 6 years, a statistic that the city has not yet confirmed or denied. Mayor Ken Welsh has said that the city will fully cooperate in DOGE's investigation, although others in the local government express worries as to how the audit will affect programs important to the city, such as city parades and DEI initiatives. The audit is set to happen on the 13th and 14th of this month. This has been Mason Chambliss with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, August 5th.
You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 67 of our Changing Environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and while the show is being broadcast on August 5th, it was recorded on July 24th.
Today we are talking with John McCarthy, the Vice President for Regional History at Marie Selby Botanical Gardens.
The views, comments, and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Our guest today is John McCarthy, and we will be talking with John about the 100 years of history in Sarasota and how he became interested in regional history. Donna, you want to talk about pre-1925?
To set the stage, just to remind people who may not have been living at the time. So in 1920 was women's suffrage, the 19th Amendment. In 1920, more than half all the cars that were sold were Model Ts, so it was still the cars were still a relatively new thing. 1920 was the first commercial radio broadcast, so that was new. Prohibition was starting in 1920. And John may have a comment later connected to Sarasota, but in 21, that's when the Field Museum was founded in Chicago. And I suspect that has some relation to the Field Club. And then as moving closer to 1925 and 1923, both Hitler and Mussolini were getting their start. And then just sort of more globally beyond Sarasota, in 1925, that's when Mein Kampf was published. The Ku Klux Klan held a march in D.C., and there were 40,000 people, Klansmen, marching in D.C. It was the year of the Scopes Monkey Trial. Al Capone took over the mob in Chicago, and there was a Florida land bubble where people had invested heavily in Florida land, and people were starting to realize a lot of it was a little wet. So with that background, let's turn to John.
So John, go ahead and start introducing us to what Sarasota and the region was like in 1925.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about 100 years today because there's no particular centennial that we're celebrating. And if we go back a little bit, some people in Sarasota probably remember back in 1986, we did celebrate a centennial, which was a 100-year anniversary of the arrival of a group of settlers from Scotland. In 1914, we celebrated the centennial of the Newtown community, Sarasota's really second African-American community. And in 1921, we celebrated the centennial of Sarasota County government being established.
So, yeah, these are 2014 and 2021, not
20. You know, so we're celebrating that. Sorry about that. But at any rate, recently I've been thinking more about, you know, the amount of activity that occurred in Sarasota, 24, 25, 26, how many buildings are now turning 100 years old, how there are businesses that have been around now for 100 years. And this was really a pivotal time in Sarasota's development. And if you were to look at kind of a year that was probably most pivotal, it was 1925. Here we are 100 years later. And so it's kind of interesting to think about, for me at least, what we had and what we did not have at that point in Sarasota's development. So, you know, we were 4 years into being our own county, having split from Manatee. In 1921, we had just gained our second railroad. So Sarasota was producing enough agricultural products and attracting enough people that it warranted a second railroad. So our first railroad arrived in 1903 with the Seaboard Airline, and then in 1924, the Atlantic Coast Line came to town.
So can I stop you there? So it used to be there was a station on Lemon Avenue, right?
Right. That was the Seaboard Airline station.
Okay. And then was it a spur? There was one further east over by where the lumber yard was?
Well, that's the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad station.
Okay. And then there was a railroad where what became the Legacy Trail? What railroad was that?
That's the Seaboard Airline down to Venice.
Oh, okay.
Whereas the Atlantic Coast Line headed east toward Arcadia, down toward Fort Ogden. And so that's the corridor that goes through, for instance, Miocic River State Park. That's the Atlantic coastline.
Oh, so when people drive down Beneva and they cross the Legacy Trail, that's the railroad that had been to the west and is now jogging over to head south?
Correct. So when the railroad first arrived in Sarasota in 1903, it came straight down Lemon Avenue to essentially First Street, where the original depot was. And then in the next year, 1904, they built a spur out to Fruitville. So that's the eastern portion heading out to Fruitville, again, to accommodate the rising production of agricultural lands. And then 1911, essentially, with the construction south toward Venice, which is now the Legacy Trail.
Okay.
And the Atlantic coastline shared part of that corridor. So actually, the portion of the Legacy Trail right now that goes from Payne Park east toward Beneva, that's double wide because there were two corridors there. There was a Seaboard Airline corridor and the Atlantic coastline.
Wow.
And then, you know, within my lifetime, those two merged into what people that have been in Sarasota probably remember as the Seaboard coastline. That was the merger of both of those railroad operations.
And what was the motivation to extend the line to Venice? Because this was before the circus, right?
Oh, long before the circus. The motivation was Bertha Palmer's desire to develop Venice as a community. And, you know, she had obtained most of the land south of Clark Road. And that was, it was all about real estate development and extending the track down to that area that she had purchased.
Okay.
Yeah, so another thing that's kind of interesting, the city of Sarasota had engaged in planning efforts and had actually hired John Nolan to come to Sarasota and provide input on how the city should grow moving forward. And John Nolan issued both a document report as well as a map plan of his visions for how Sarasota could be improved. So that's pretty progressive, really, when you think about it, that the city engaged planner at that time. Of course, the reason why that happened then was because of all the growth that was occurring. We had two newspapers in Sarasota by the end of 1925, the Sarasota Herald, which is grown into what is now the Herald Tribune, and the Sarasota Daily Times, which was a daily paper that had extended what the weekly paper had done called the Sarasota Times since 1899. So again, Sarasota is large enough to require two newspapers at this point.
So let's go back to the planning. So Nolan worked in Sarasota before he worked in Venice?
Correct.
And you know, most cities, or I won't say most, many cities that you go to, particularly those laid out on a grid, have streets and avenues, and the streets run one way and the avenues run the other way. And here we're blessed with kumquats, pineapples, lemons, ospreys, coconuts. Whose idea was it to name the majority of the downtown streets after tropical things?
Sure. So that goes back to that very first centennial in 1986 celebrated, which was the platting of downtown Sarasota in 1885 and the arrival of the colonists from the British Isles in 1886. And so that original plan had some of the street names that you mentioned. And so people kind of get the history confused. So I'll tell you the ones on the original plat.
Okay.
You had Palm Avenue. You had Pineapple Avenue. You had Orange Avenue, Lemon Avenue, which we're all familiar with today. You had Strawberry Avenue, where Ringling Boulevard is today. And you had Banana Avenue, where the North Tamiami Trail is today, running up from the end of Gulfstream. So you mentioned Osprey Avenue. Well, Osprey Avenue is named for what?
The town of Osprey.
A bird.
Thank you, Julie, because most people would say the fish hawk bird.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, right now, as we're doing this interview, I am within the walls of the old Osprey Post Office here at Historic Spanish Point campus of Selby Gardens. And Osprey Avenue is essentially the road to get to where I am right now today. So the town was named for the fish hawk, but the road was named for how you got to the town. And similarly, there's, you know, Sarasota-Venice Road, which was the road to Venice, and the Englewood Road, which was the road that led to Englewood. It was all part of the same road, but that was one of them. And then, you know, and then we have things like Lime Avenue, which seemed to fit the fruity context of those other names, but came much later. Yeah, if there's any other street names you're curious about, just let me know. But the idea behind this was to attract people here from the British Isles, and to a tropical paradise. And so, hey, if there's oranges and lemons and pineapples and, you know, all that stuff, that's got to be a great place to live.
Yeah. No Sanspur Avenue.
No, plenty of Sanspurs.
Yeah. But this was a promotional effort to
sure, sure it was.
Yeah.
And it worked. It worked to a great extent. It you know, it did attract a lot of people to come here. Most of them were dissatisfied with what they found here and abandoned the Sarasota project, but others stayed. And that's really what developed the downtown core where it is today. I mean, Sarasota, the original Sarasota post office was located down near the intersection of Hillview and Osprey. So that's where the original kind of colony of Sarasota was. But because of the real estate effort, where downtown is today, is how that got shifted to being the center of Sarasota and the downtown area.
Well, and you probably know this, but when Julie and I lived on what we called Third Street and we now call Fruitville, there was a alley behind the house. On the north side of the alley was a sand pine. So downtown Sarasota was tremendous sort of nosebleed elevation. When you go up Boulevard of the Arts or 6th Street, you can see how much higher that land is. And so,
You even see it on Main Street. You know, you got Lower Main that's, you know, reaching down or reaching up, depending upon your perspective. And then, as you say, as you go further north, you do get into a much higher sand ridge situation. Yeah, and John Nolan's plan, you know, he introduced the notion of roundabouts, for instance. He shows one on Golden Gate Point where the bridge was at that time proposed to go out to the islands. He also showed a lot of green space corridors where he anticipated, you know, linear parks along certain features, one of them being what's historically called the rim ditch, which is basically the drainage conveyance that's on the north side of 10th Street. That was perceived as a green space corridor. He also envisioned a center hub for government that would have been on Main Street, you know, between Orange and Osprey Avenue, this notion of that's where the core of government is going to be. So he really gave the city a lot of suggestions. I don't see any evidence that the city really implemented any part of his plan.
Okay. So talk about the Ringling era and the development of St. Armand's and all of that.
Sure. Well, Julie, that kind of fits in. So let's talk a little bit more about what Sarasota had, and then we'll get to what Sarasota didn't have.
Okay.
You know, because it's kind of, I see it as like that. So we had two newspapers. We had two skyscrapers at that point, if you can call them skyscrapers. We had the Sarasota Hotel, which most people probably know as Palm Towers, at the corner of Palm Avenue and Main Street, kind of that north east corner there. And then the First Bank and Trust Building that was built by Joseph Lord up at Five Points, which most people know as the Palmer Bank. And we had spring training of baseball. We had the New York Giants here. We had Payne Park as a baseball stadium that had kind of been built by the community to accommodate the New York Giants. We had out-of-door school, believe it or not. Out-of-door school is 101 years old. So, you know, founded by two women who were very interested in education and in the arts. And in fact, 4 years, 5 years after they founded the out-of-door school, they founded the Players Community Theater. So, but that's 1929, getting a little ahead of ourselves. There was one bridge in the area, and that was the Bay Bridge that went out to the north end of what was called Little Sarasota Key. People know that today as Siesta Key, but no one would have called it Siesta Key in the 1920s. They might have said they're going to Siesta, which was a small subdivision at the north end of Little Sarasota Key. But nobody would have said in the 1920s they were going to Siesta Key. They would have gone to Little Sarasota Key. We had 24/7 electricity in Sarasota, which, you know, everybody kind of expects that today. But that came in right after the county was formed. And that was a big deal to have 24/7 electricity, because before that it was turn it on so you could do your ironing and turn it back off, you know.
So how was that electricity generated?
Oh, it was generated with a diesel generator. And that's how electricity was generated in most communities. A large diesel flywheel engine that was very efficient, running a genset or a generator. In the case of Sarasota, electricity first, you know, came here at the same time that our ability to create artificial ice and those sorts of things. So that's going back in time. And also, you know, by 1925, their work was moving forward on the Fruitville Drainage District, which was essentially to restructure Philippi Creek and drain the sawgrass areas so that those could be greater agricultural areas. And that's essentially what we know today as the celery fields, where the Audubon Nature Center is and the county stormwater facility and that sort of thing. There were dozens of new subdivisions. I mean, this was a time of tremendous growth.
Let's go back to the Fruitville Drainage District. So they had to drain it before the celery really became a thing, right?
Correct, correct. And so, when they drained it, they didn't know celery was going to be the thing.
Right.
they found celery to be the thing, you know, within the muckiest of the mucklands. And there was you know, about 2,000 acres of muck that was exposed for farming by that work.
Yeah.
But yeah, they tried everything, and the celery is really what thrived, and there was a big demand for celery, and Sarasota was, you know, one of the world's greatest celery producers because of all that. Yeah, and lots of new subdivisions. I mean, this was a time if everybody was trying to make money by taking parcels of land and subdividing them up and selling to folks, and the advertisements all hyped like it's almost too late to buy this land. You're not going to be able to afford it in the future. You got to get it now. There was a lot of hype. And this was also a time when the shoreline started changing, where real estate development was using dredge and fill projects to elevate waterfront land and at the same time providing a little bit of deep water for boats and things like that. So that's kind of like what Sarasota was like. And then as far as, Julie, your question about the Ringling stuff, you know, John Ringling first came to Sarasota before 1910 on a houseboat, and he bought property here in 1910-11. But his activities were really in the 1920s. And so, but again, in 1925, there was no museum yet. He was talking about a museum. There was no art school. There was no talk of it. There was no circus winter quarters. I mean, that was announced in 1927. So everybody thinks of Sarasota like as the circus city, but you would not have thought of Sarasota as the circus city in 1925. Again, there's no causeway to Lido. In fact, Lido as a name didn't even exist yet. That was 1926.
So is it true that the Ringlings were attracted to Sarasota because of the Caples?
Well, Ringling had a couple friends here. Charles Thompson, who was manager for Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show. Ralph Caples, who was involved in railroad logistics. So between Caples, Thompson, a gentleman named Butler, who actually was friends with Caples, I think they all kind of convinced him to come down here.
Okay. Well, the Caples honeymooned in Sarasota in 1898, and when Julie and I were students, Mrs. Caples was still alive. So that's quite a story.
Well, you know, maybe we'll talk about that later on, but it is amazing how the people that, you know, you could have talked to back in the early 1980s,
yeah,
who you can't talk to anymore, and all the history that they held.
So something I wanted to share, and I'd mentioned this to you when we were talking about the show, there's a strange little booklet that was produced on a typewriter, and it's called A History of Agriculture of Sarasota County, sponsored by the Sarasota County Agricultural Fair Association and the Sarasota County Historical Commission. And it's got a lot of information, and it's missing a lot of dates, so it's really hard to figure out what happened when. But I wanted to read, you were talking about development, I wanted to read one paragraph. This is from page 12. During the 20s, in quotes, much of the land was owned by banks and investment companies, and there were even some land subdivided into 10 and 20-acre plots. When the bust came in 1928, most of the owners stopped paying taxes on the land they owned, and in 1931, the Murphy Act was passed in order to get the land back on the tax rolls. The Murphy law: if taxes were delinquent, any man could pay the taxes for 2 years on the land and then get a quitclaim deed for it. Then if the former owner did not claim the land for another 2 years, the new owner could pay for two more years of taxes and get a deed that would stand up in court. Much of the land in the area was obtained after the Murphy Law passed, just for taxes, which amounted to about $2.50 an acre. Some of the owners paid their taxes right through the Depression, and they had much more invested in the land. The Ringling Tract, just east of the Mack River, is a good example of where they paid the taxes right on through the Depression. So a lot of the history of Northport was tied up in Murphy Act acquisition from the Frizzell Ranch or whatever.
A lot of the eastern ranch lands protected through the Environmentally Sensitive Lands Program was acquired by the families who either still own fee simple title to it and have conservation easements, or maybe they've sold some. The Carlton family, the Longino family, they all acquired that property through the Murphy Act in the 1930s.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, essentially keeping it all from becoming subdivisions in the 1920s, right?
Yeah.
Just a few other things that we didn't have in 25. The county seat had not been determined. You know, it's kind of defaulted to downtown Sarasota, where the courthouse was built in 1927. But at that time, we didn't really know where the county seat was going to be. There was a lot of pull to put it down in Venice, where it had been more central, but that did not occur. You would have never heard anybody say the word Tamiami Trail, because there were sections of hard road that had been paved along the West Coast, but the actual connection across the Everglades had not been made. So you would not have heard the term Tamiami Trail. You would have heard, again, things like Sarasota Venice Road, Inglewood Road, that sort of thing. There was no island park, no city island. Those are dredge projects from years later. And a lot of the landmarks that people think about when they think of Sarasota, like the old El Vernona Hotel, which was the John Ringling Towers, that was not built. It wasn't there in 25. So anyway, we weren't yet the air-conditioned city. You know, years later, we were called the air-conditioned city, and everybody thinks, oh, that's what we were called back in the old days. Well, we were called that after air conditioning became a thing, but nobody would have called Sarasota the air-conditioned city back in the 1920s. And just to kind of put one more little cap on, I liked how, you know, Jono talked about what was going on, you know, in other places. There were no legal alcohol sales in Sarasota because prohibition was regulating the consumption of alcohol. Actually, not the consumption, the sale, transport, and manufacture of it nationwide. So those people who could afford to stock up as the prohibition was heading their way, they would like buy out all of the liquor stores and distributors. And it was not illegal to consume it during prohibition, but just to manufacture, transport, or sell. So now there was liquor here.
Yeah. So now we have liquor, but it's illegal to make, sell, or transport artificial meat in Florida. So let's talk about when tourists were arriving in Model Ts and they had the trees that could be converted into campers. What road were they arriving on, and how did they start interacting with downtown or Sarasota? What was the main route in?
Right. So depending upon when you came, you would have come down what is now the North Trail. You would have taken a left at Palm Avenue. You would have taken another left at Main Street. And so Main Street was part of that original corridor. And then if you were heading south, you would have taken that right turn on either Orange Avenue or Osprey Avenue. But you would have been exposed to Main Street. So that's how most people would have come. And they would have come, you know, through Tampa and through Bradenton, and then they would have come on down into Sarasota. And if they were heading south, they would go along the corridor where the Tamiami Trail runs today, although there certainly were lots of little dog legs, I guess you'd have to call them, where instead of the road going straight, it followed the section lines. And those have mostly been smoothed out, but little sections like at Vamo or Old Venice Road and other areas further south. So that's pretty much the same route that we use today.
So if what we call 41 now was the main route down from Bradenton, when did the mom and pop motels and the attractions like the Jungle Gardens and the glass blowers and the cars and music of yesterday and the circus museum, all of those cropped up along the highway? What's the timing on all of that?
That's post World War II. You know, that is the second boom that hit Sarasota with the war being over, a lot of servicemen and women who were involved in the two air bases, one at Sarasota Bradenton Airport, one at what is now the Venice Airport. You know, while they were here, they fell in love with Sarasota. Simultaneous, you've got, you know, people, again, you know, real estate development kind of seizing the opportunity that with the war being over, people were looking for new places to live. There were a lot of retirees. And so people began, you know, selling Florida as a retiree, a place to retire. And so the various artist attractions like the glass blowers that you mentioned, there was a little artist colony that was operated by Mr. and Mrs. Hilliard that would teach you how to do ceramics and copper enameling and painting and things like this. That was kind of a neat little place up there. And then you started having the restaurants and, of course, the hotels. And really, those are motels because you drove up in your car. You know, I learned when I was a child, a hotel is where you kind of walk in and a motel is where you drive up. Okay. And, you know, you had your own little parking spot right in front of your room. You had a swimming pool. By the time you get into the 1950s, you saw a sign that said air conditioned, and that would lure you in. And then, of course, you know, if you stayed at a hotel there, you were just moments from the beach. So
John, you mentioned that Island Park and Bird Key were filled, And do we know anything about whether St. Armand's was filled and whether Lido Beach was filled as well?
Well, I can assure you that John Ringling dredged, well, you know, Owen Burns working for John Ringling dredged around St. Armand's and built it up a little bit from the island that it once was. But I seriously question people who say that Ringling consolidated Lido by dredging the beachfront, because I do not believe that's what happened. Now, if you look back at older surveys and things like that, you can see that Lido itself was a series of mangrove islands and sandbars and stuff like that. And in 1921, we had a massive hurricane. And in 1926, we had a massive hurricane. And that hurricane on Lido in 26 really brought in the sand. So I think that people's perception is that Ringling dredged up all of Lido. And I just don't think that's true. His focus was St. Armand's. He did, you know, dredged up a little corridor there on Otter Key that you can see today if you go exploring out there. And he did dredge from the original Bird Key, which was a very small island surrounded by seagrass. He dredged up to his causeway, and he dredged the components that he needed for the causeway. So there was a lot of dredging going on. The dredge boat is still basically rusting off of Otter Key. And Otter Key is where the dredge boat captain lived. Mm-hmm. So that's why the boat ended up there. But that was Owen Burns. It was a hydraulic dredge. It had two big suction pipes. And it would suck out the bay bottom and then spew it up wherever you wanted to deposit it in a hydraulic dredging.
Yeah, my research agrees with yours. I found an article where I think there were cabanas on St. Armand's and people would walk out to the beach. So, and then there's the whole question. There was the Great Gale of 1848 or whatever. Right. And I think Lido may have been the south end of Longboat at that point.
Correct. So the story goes that it was the 1848 hurricane that opened that up. William Whitaker told the surveyors it was called New Pass, and we're still calling it New Pass.
Yeah.
So John, part of the reason that St. Armand's floods is because the sea level was lower when it was constructed. And that means that the storm drains are it's flooding with salt water into the circle of St. Armand's.
Well, so, and they didn't put that much dredge material upon it.
Right.
Okay. You know, so there was enough dry land on that particular island to support cabbage palms and cedars and things like that. There was an occupant of the island when it was called Deer Key. His name was St. Armand. He actually was the engineer on the first locomotive to come to Sarasota, which predated the Seaboard Airline. But that's a whole nother story. And he lived out there. It was called Deer Key. And so there was some elevation to begin with. They seemed to add a little bit more, but perhaps more in extent than in height.
Yeah, so, I don't think there was too much added, because when you first drive out towards the circle, there's the church on the right. And if you go in there, there's cedar trees, there's strangler figs, there's cabbage palms. And then if you look at the center of St. Armand's Circle, it's full of cabbage palms. And those are not arrayed in a design that someone deliberately would have planted them in. They're not concentric circles. They're not radiating lines. It's not a grid. They're just kind of random palm trees. So I think those are pre-existing. And it's true that you can put some fill around a palm tree, but I don't think much fill was put in there myself.
Yeah, I think it was spread out, He was wanting to build and did build. Owen Burns, for the most part, built houses along the shoreline, you know, facing east and such. So it was just enough to be able to accommodate what he was trying to achieve, which was to sell waterfront property in what he called Ringling Isles.
Yeah.
Now, Jonna, you'd mentioned the bathing, the little cabanas out there, and you were actually the one that brought that to my attention. But in looking into it further, what I understand is that if you could imagine being in that circle today, where the palms are, where you're talking about,
yeah,
that was basically, if you were looking west, that was the shoreline. And there was a big, flat area of very shallow water that had kind of a sandbar on the north and a sandbar on the south. But that was the area that was perceived as being safe for swimming.
Because, and so
if you look at the 1883 U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, you can see that. And you can see how that central core, what we call kind of the St. Armand's Park in the center of Harding Circle, that was kind of, you know, the dry land, if you will. But then west of that, there was nothing but that shallow water. So that kind of made it an ideal swimming location. Not as much threat from sharks, which was a big concern of people swimming back then, because they were fisher folk, a lot of them, and they knew that there were sharks out there.
You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And to help the community prepare for hurricane season, Sarasota County will host self-service sandbag operations on July 19th and August 10th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at three locations, Ed Smith Stadium, Twin Lakes Park, and South County Fleet. Each self-service location will have empty bags and sand. Residents will need to fill and then load their own sandbags into their vehicles, as well as bring their own shovels and gloves. There will be limited shovels for use on site. For more information is available at scgov.net or by calling 941-861-5000. That's 941-861-5000. John, what else would you like to talk about this region's history?
Well, as y'all know, I've kind of been fascinated with this region's history for a long time. And I feel like with so many new people coming to Sarasota all the time, discovering this as a wonderful place to live, I think it gives people a sense of place, a little better understanding of their new home to learn a little bit more about the history. And so when I've had the opportunity to share with people who are newcomers, you know, they seem fascinated by, you know, just the tremendous amount of different things that have happened in the Sarasota community. So I think it's really important for people to understand the history of where we've come from, how Sarasota has developed. There have been some really good things that have happened. There have probably been some mistakes that have been made. And but it's good to be aware of that. And I just find it, you know, I got interested in it when I was in high school. I'd ride my bicycle all over Sarasota, and I saw old buildings and I saw different things. And I was looking at the street signs saying, who are these people that these streets were named after? And that was kind of what piqued my interest at the beginning. I wasn't particularly interested in history in school. History in school seemed like all it was about was like the history of wars. Whereas Sarasota history was about this history of people and a place, you know, and how the original settlers came into what, you know, they all describe as this paradise. You know, whether they were attracted by the opportunity for land through the Southern Homestead Act or whether they were attracted to come fishing and hunting. But virtually everyone described it as paradise. And in fact, you know, when my mom came to Florida in 1952 from Massachusetts, that's what she said. That's what she said for her whole life. She said, you know, I found paradise. And so I just find it fascinating to be able to share with people the knowledge that I've accumulated over what's now been like 47 years of asking questions about Sarasota history. And so I just feel like it's really important. And I'm really gratified when I see that other people are interested in the history, and you start to see Facebook pages about Sarasota history and websites and things like that. You know, anytime I get in a conversation with someone, if it turns to history, you know, they always seem to be fascinated with what I have to say. So I just keep talking about it.
So Sarasota has a history of arts, painting, sculpture, writing. Was that happening as early as 25 or not?
Well, I've been doing research on that recently and can tell you that, you know, the fine art appreciation in Sarasota, I think, started to be shared by Bertha Palmer. So within a couple of years of her coming here from Chicago, and of course, this is the woman that introduced America to Impressionist art, and she introduced Sarasota to fine art. And what she did was she was supporting the Women's Club. And as soon as they had their little Women's Club building over there at Coconut and Palm Avenue, she started bringing a woman named Eleanor Bingham down from Chicago, and she was a well-known art lecturer. And so Eleanor would come down and do these lectures at the Women's Club and talk about various artists. And to me, that's kind of the start of the fine art. And then you started to see, there's one young woman lived here in Sarasota, Nellie Spears. She started doing watercolor sketches. She had a little art store downtown, started selling her stuff and some art supplies and gifts and souvenirs and that sort of thing. You then start to see in the 1920s, as more and more people are coming here. Again, if you think about art, art is, in my mind, inspired by like one or two things. It's either nature or it's emotional angst, you know? And so the nature that was here was so inspirational to people. You know, Frederick Remington had gone to Arcadia back in the early days and you know, painted the cow hunters, you know? And so in the 1920s, there are more and more people coming here. So it might be interesting to know that in the 1920s, the Sarasota County school system had an art department. In fact, it was headed up by the same woman that started what's now the Art Center Sarasota. And so that's 1920s. Clearly, the Ringling bringing the museum, doing the partnership to create the original Ringling College, really set the stage, because now you've got art instructors coming to Sarasota to teach, but they're also practicing their art in the community. Now you've got other artists coming in. So when you look at the 1930s and the 1940s was really the time of blossoming of not just the artists, you know, but also the performing arts and also the literary arts, because of course Sarasota became this huge magnet for all those things almost simultaneously, where you had all the writers like McKinley Cantor and John D. McDonald and, you know, Borden Beale and many others. And then you had all these artists, men and women, who came here to practice their craft surrounded by nature. And then you had wealthy people coming here as visitors, as part-time residents, as full-time residents. And so there was the patron, you know, the patron, someone to buy the art. And so you had this combination of inspiration, talent, and purchasing power, which I think is what fueled it all up.
So there was a pretty well-worn trail between the Midwest, between Chicago and of course, the Ringlings that started Wisconsin. And so let's go back to the Field Club. What's the connection with the Field Club and the Midwest?
The connection to the Midwest started before Bertha Palmer, but clearly Bertha Palmer was the most famous person from the Midwest, in this case Chicago, that came to Sarasota in 1910, and many other people followed. So she kind of created this little Chicago colony. There was Mabel Lynn, who owned what's now the Philippi Estate Park property, and then she sold that to Edson Keith, who was, you know, a milliner in Chicago, and he comes down with his wife, and he and Nettie, they came down to be permanent residents. They weren't seasonal. The Philippi Mansion, that was designed to be a year-round residence, and there are design features to it that make that more palatable without air conditioning in the summertime. And so Stanley Field, who was the founder of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, he came in the 1920s. He and his wife came in the 1920s. And so they were kind of the last of the Chicago colony to arrive. But if you think about the positioning along the bay, you had Honoré Palmer and his wife Grace living at what's now the Landings. Just north of there, you had the Field residents. Just south of there on Philippi Creek, you had the Edson Keiths. And then you had Potter Palmer Jr. by the 1920s, 1930s, living at the Oaks in Osprey. So the Chicago colony was kind of like spread out all over the bayfront, but kind of started with Joseph H. Lord, who sold most of the property to Bertha Palmer, and then, you know, continues. And then as the roadway corridors developed, you know, US 41 goes right up Lakeshore Drive, right in front of where Bertha Palmer's stone castle was. It didn't do that back then, but it does now. And so generally people from the Midwest came down and settled on the west coast of Florida, and basically people coming out of, you know, the New York area, they settled on the east coast of Florida. And that was just the way the road and the railroad corridors were functioning at that time.
Let me reintroduce our guest today. He is John McCarthy, and he's the Vice President for Regional History at Marie Selby Botanical Gardens.
Well, Julie, that is a great segue into Selby Gardens Presents the High Life, Contemporary Photography and the Birds from July 19th through September 14th at the downtown Sarasota campus. This exhibition will feature 70 works by more than 50 photographers from around the world. The works will be presented in the galleries of the Museum of Botany and the Arts and outside throughout the garden. So for more information, that's available at selby.org or call 941-366-5731.
Well, that's a great exhibition. It just opened up last week. We're getting some real positive feedback from it. And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, Selby Gardens being located where it is and being the Bayfront Sanctuary that it is, we've documented like 160 species of birds utilizing the property at one time or another. So it's kind of cool to do an exhibition on birds. And so we welcome everyone to come out. It's going to run through September 14th. We've got a nice exhibition going on at the Spanish Point campus as well. And it's photography from the rock icon Patti Smith. And it's all inspired by her book called A Book of Days, where she has photographs from around the world, one photograph for every day. And our curator, Dr. David Berry, selected one photograph from every month. And we've displayed them outside on aluminum panels. And people are enjoying that. And they will be able to continue to enjoy that through August 31st. So go downtown campus, Selby Gardens, come down to the Spanish Point campus. Two great exhibitions going on right now.
So maybe you could help our listeners out. What do you think is the appropriate pronunciation for Mrs. Palmer's children?
Well, it's really her maiden name. It's Honoré, and it's pronounced Honoré. And there's no doubt that it's pronounced Honoré, and Bertha pronounced it Honoré, and her son Honoré Palmer pronounced it Honoré. And so what you find is that people that have lived in Sarasota for a long time call it Honor and insist that it's Honor. But when a street is named for a person, it really should be pronounced in the manner that the family pronounced the name. And the Honoré is an old French family that goes way back. And Bertha Palmer was very proud of her French ancestry. A lot of her jewelry that she bought through Tiffany was former French royal jewels. And, of course, again, she was enamored with the art that was being produced both by the Barbizon School out in the forest of France and also the Impressionist artists, and essentially was the biggest mover and shaker to introduce America to Impressionist art and frankly kept people like Monet afloat with her purchases. So, Emma.
Yeah. So how bad were the mosquitoes in the early years?
Well, you know, you don't read a lot about it. You don't read a lot about it. And it's fascinating to me because it even makes me wonder if maybe, you know, when things were more in a natural state, if things were more balanced. But also, I think that, you know, people's habits were different then. They got up when the sun got up and they did what they had to do. They probably wore more clothing than we did because of the bugs. And then, you know, people, when the sun went down, they went to bed, you know, so they certainly had mosquito netting, you know, on their beds. You know, by the turn of the century, 1900, you could get screen for your windows. I remember one story where a person described where here's what you do to keep the mosquitoes away. You open up all your windows, you light your kerosene lamp, you put it outside, all the mosquitoes go to the lamp, you run back inside and close the windows. So, you know, I mean, so they were definitely an issue, but I think that people were tougher back then. And I think that people protected their skin more back then. And I think people just sucked it up and it was just part of the thing. But I'll tell you, I'll trade mosquitoes as long as I get to paradise. I'll take that.
Yeah.
Well, and this, we've touched on this earlier. History's written by the winners, that the people that were promoting Florida and making money and publishing the books were interested in a kind of a positive spin on things. And the people that were miserable and had no money and were being bitten to death probably weren't recording as much.
Well, but I'm even thinking about old letters and things like that that I've read. You know, people talk about a lot of things, but I'm trying to think of one example where somebody wrote home and talked about how bad the mosquitoes were. So, you know, again, no see-ums irritate me more than mosquitoes anyway. So,
well, and they go right through screens.
They go right through screens. So that's a whole nother story. So, and as you said,
So let's talk about the arc of fishing in this region.
Well, you know, back in the 1600s, 1700s, these fishermen began to come up along the coasts of Florida to catch fish for the Easter feast. And so it was kind of a seasonal thing at the start. And then it became a bigger thing. And then they discovered there was a lot of turtles on the beach on the west coast and east coast of Florida in the summertime. And so then it became about, you know, fishing and turtles. And they were catching pompano and mullet and all sorts of fish out in the bays. And then salting, you know, gutting that fish, salting it, drying it in the sun, packing it in barrels, sending it back to Cuba, making a lot of money. So that really went on for a couple hundred years. The fact that our Selby Gardens Historic Spanish Point campus is called Historic Spanish Point is because the Webb family, when they came down from New York in 1867, they did a little stopover in Key West, and they run into this fisherman or trader, and he says, "Hey, there's this great place that I know about. It would be a great place for you to, you know, build a home." And so the thought is that this was a camp, you know, at one point. And John Webb, the homesteader, found Spanish olive jar pottery, which he sent to the Smithsonian. And that's kind of part of that documentation. But there was a fish camp in what's now Cherokee Park. It was operated by Philippe Bermudez. That's who Philippe Creek is named for. There was a fish camp up north of Van Wezel, operated by El Zuarte. So we had two or three fish camps that were operating here. And that was all the way up through the 1840s. And then you started having people like Bill Whitaker, who came here from Tallahassee area. And he was a fisherman, got into cattle ranching and citrus and all that stuff, too, because that's what you did. But primarily fishing. And then people came. So there was kind of fishing to eat. There was fishing to sell, mostly to Cuba. And then there was sports fishing, which attracted people in the early years as well. Over time, the fishing would become bigger and bigger and bigger. And, Julie, you've probably seen some of my slides at one time or another where I show, you know, 10 boxcar loads of mullet shipped out in a day, you know? And, you know, this was 1910, 11, 12, the Lemon Avenue, was essentially the railroad, and it curved where Ringling is now, where Strawberry was, and it ran out into a dock on the bay, and the fishermen would bring their boats up from there and they would just load it into the boxcars. You know, the early people describe the schools of mullet that, like, you could probably walk across their backs across the bay. Millions of fish jumping to keep you up at night, to literally keep you up at night. The kingfish runs that would come in Big Pass and run up through what they called Palm Sound, or what's now Big Sarasota Bay North, up behind Longboat. Kingfish would run for like 2 days. You know, the school would come in. And it would come in, and it would keep coming for 2 days. I mean, so the productivity of the natural environment here was just exquisite. And, you know, some people saw that as just a way to feed the family. Other people saw it as a way to earn some money. Other people saw it as a way to get rich. And they did.
Yeah, I think Sarasota had a reputation as a tarpon capital that was comparable at one point to Boca Grande.
Well, in fact, you'll see articles in the paper where the fishermen kind of joke and say, "Hey, that article is in the last week's paper about so-and-so catching that fish off of Boca Grande. He was so far off of Boca Grande that he was right offshore Little Sarasota Key." you know, and so it's kind of funny. But, yeah, so they had, you know, tarpon tournament in Venice, I think in 26, brought it to Sarasota, 27, skipped a year or two, and then cranked it back up in 1930, and they've held it ever since. And tarpon, of course, is a game fish. Nobody eats them, but it's a fighting fish, and people want to fight them and bring in the biggest one. So, yeah, but Sarasota was big on tarpon for sure. Yeah, Boca Grande has tarpon, but Sarasota has tarpon. And, you know, in the summertime, you see them rolling off out in the Gulf there. So they're out there still.
Anything else you'd like to talk about, John?
Well, again, I feel like the more people know about the community in which they live, the more they feel a part of that community. And learning a little bit more about history is one way to do that. And I had someone ask me one day, they said they were in a position where they were going to have to quickly learn a lot about Sarasota history to do something that they wanted to do. And I said, well, just learn one new thing every day. You know, when I started doing research on history in Sarasota, you had to go to the historical archives building and, you know, pour through the files and look for what you wanted. Now you can do a lot of research online. So if you're curious about your neighborhood, you're curious about the street that you live on, you're curious about some building in town, you kind of Google it and see what comes up. It's not all 100% accurate. I always, you know, get a kick out of reading some of the stuff and wanting to debunk it. But there's a lot of good information out there now. And the county has a history center that has an amazing collection of items related to Sarasota. They're currently housed at the historic Osprey Library in Osprey, Florida. And people can go and learn more about it. And I think if people do learn more about our history, they'll have a greater appreciation for those that preceded them and what Sarasota is all about. And to me, that's what makes Sarasota such a special place. You know, find another place on the west coast of Florida that had so many different things going on, so many different people coming here and having a big influence. And much of the influence is still here today. I mean, Sarasota is still known as an arts community. Sarasota is known as a science community. Sarasota has a tremendous reputation, and Sarasota is the only one of its kind. There's only one Sarasota on the planet. It's not like Springfield, where there's like one in several states. There's only one Sarasota. And so it's one of the things that makes the community so special. And of course, Sarasota has an identity crisis. It's a city and a county.
Well, you know? Sarts was a breath mint and a candy mint, so we can make that work.
So
the History Center is no longer out near the celery fields?
They're building a new one out there.
Okay.
Yeah, they're building a new one.
I was worried when it was in the Chidsey Library that a storm was going to come and take everything out. And so having it anywhere near the coast just makes me nervous. So I'm glad they'll have a new one.
They'll have something going on there pretty soon.
And I think local history and regional history is really part of a sense of place for people who are looking for a sense of place. And I think that really, I think engaging with local and regional history is really important to an important component to sense of place.
Well, John, thanks again for taking time with us and sharing stuff. I'm sure many of our listeners are learning things, so this is great.
Well, thanks to you both.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show, number 67, featured John McCarthy chatting with us about Sarasota a century ago.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment. This is a great place to hear about recent shows. Tune in next week at 9 a.m. for the Healthy Living Hour with Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on August 19th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.